was an unexpected and interesting noise.
Skype noises.
Hate it.
Oh, yeah. Wait, hang on. My Dropbox didn't quit itself. Goodbye. My smart sync failed to download two files. Just great.
Guess it's not really that smart, huh?
No, it's incredibly stupid.
but that's life. Just how things go. Hopefully, you don't hear a dog that is barking and has been barking since I got home about 15 minutes ago. And I'm not sure why that is.
I hear no dogs.
Oh, that's good. So, yeah. Because I was about to ask, who let the dogs out?
I don't know. It's your apartment.
Okay. Well, I mean, obviously they're not even out. They're sitting in an apartment barking, so.
Well, the owners are presumably out.
Yes, yes. Did I ever tell you about the one time that someone left like a German Shepherd by itself, seemingly for extended period of time? It's unclear to me exactly how long, but it started howling in the middle of the night, presumably out of neglect, and so I had to actually call the BHPD to come in and deal with the sitch.
You have not relayed that story. Was everything all right? Was the dog in peril?
It doesn't seem that it was in peril, but the details are a little fuzzy because it was like 3 a.m, so I didn't talk to the officers once they got here. Very shortly after that, I think within the matter of days, that person moved out, either evicted or decided that he didn't want people calling police on his dogs that he left alone.
Are you certain that he didn't die and the dog was crying for help?
Well, that's a possibility.
You didn't happen to see any like coroner's vans or anything show up that evening?
I feel like that would have like been a bigger deal.
Well, I mean, you don't want the property value to go down, so you don't really want to publicize that kind of thing.
No, and this was also a person in the other building who would frequently throw parties, and he had one of those, those little spinny light ball things with the red, green, and blue lights.
That little thing you put on like an end table and it just spins around and blasts a bunch of party lights all over the walls?
The real, real tacky stuff. So he had those going in his thing in the building across, so I could see that he was having a real good time most of the time. So I feel like he was maybe a partier who maybe didn't always take great care of his dogs. But
and that was the last straw, calling the cops.
Well, I mean, at a certain point, you're just like, they've been there for like a couple days and I haven't seen that guy and they've been howling. So I feel like this is important to like alert somebody. I don't think he was like showing up during the day, feeding them, and then leaving. But yeah.
Well, that's good of you to think of the dog.
I don't generally like to call the Beverly Hills Police Department.
had a rough and tumble organization.
Yeah. Oh no. I mean, the other time I had to call them was when my car got broken into in the carport because I live in an unsafe neighborhood, and the robbers had hit or burglars. Not really, I can't remember the exact terminology, but they smashed and grabbed four different cars in the alley that same night, and apparently it had been a pattern that had been going on, I had to deal with the BHPD, where they came out and were slowly working their way through the four people who had the break-in and who had their cars broken into, and they even sent a crime lab van.
Oh.
And the lady dusted for fingerprints, which, as near as I can tell, just made a mess. I don't think it actually did anything. I think it's one of those things.
Did
that
she really dust, or was she just like blowing some powder on the door handle to make you feel better?
Oh yeah, I feel like it is purely something to make people feel like work is being done, because, you know, this is like...
it's Beverly Hills. They know their demographic.
Yeah, they know that it's just old people who sit at home and watch CSI. And so they're going to be like, why don't you do a DNA trace on the person who broke into my car? And
there are epithelial cells on my steering wheel. You should find this person.
Yeah, no. So anyway, those are the two run-ins with a BHPD in my local area. But yeah. Generally, they just harass people who are sitting on sidewalks asking for money. But that's you know, it's what the residents of Beverly Hills seem to want. So,
well, maybe they could be sleeper agents. You don't know.
No, I highly doubt it. But speaking of agents and enforcement, and I guess a form of neglecting your wife or future wife. Let's talk about the Mission first of several Mission Impossible movies that I had never seen before.
We're in uncharted mission territory here for you.
Yes, Mission Uncharted. And it is Mission Impossible is Roman numeral 3. I'm not really clear on the numbering mechanics and naming conventions of this series, because they seem to change their mind.
Well, on a different frequent basis. Outlets label them as different things. IMDb, I think, has all of them as Roman numerals thus far, but they're like Wikipedia and things kind of don't necessarily.
No, because Mission Impossible. But even if you look at the movie posters, Mission Impossible 2 was stylized as a 2.
Oh, look at that. There is a 2, but yeah. It on IMDb, it is named with the Roman numerals. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well, you know, they get rid of all that dumb crap after this, and they just go to the fun tagline names, which make it really easy to forget which one came after which.
I have had that sense when I've been talking to people about Mission Impossible or seen them talking about it, like when like Dan Morin or Todd Vaziri or something, they're talking on Twitters, and it always seems a little confusing what the order of operations is for these. But another thing that I noticed about this third movie that I saw for the first time is how they went back to the there's a turncoat in the organization. Well, for the third time.
luckily, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but luckily this is the last time they drew water from that well, because I think they also realized that it was getting a little old.
Yeah, but this movie is thankfully formatted very differently from Mission Impossible 2, and it's got a different creative style on it than the first Mission Impossible movie. Brian De Palma liked to have tension, very quiet building of tension that occurred. JJ is of the just keep running and things are happening school of tension, where
explosions and cut faster, run faster, louder music.
Yeah, everything's just amp all the way up, which is not the same kind of thing. I think I do prefer De Palma's approach to slowly building tension over time, and making the audience, you know, aware of a ticking clock or things that the characters on screen aren't aware of, watching that tension play out. Whereas JJ's like, yeah, so explosion, more explosions.
Yeah, well, the original was much more spies doing spy things, and it's a spy series movie thing. This one is like action movie group of ostensible spies or whatever, but we're just gonna punch the mission until we succeed, which I mean kind of goes in line with the whole impossible mission force thing. It's just like, against all odds, they're gonna keep fighting even when they're about to die, and then eventually they'll win.
Yeah, but speaking of impossible mission force, I love that moment at the very end with Michelle Monaghan and Tom Cruise, where he says he works for IMF, impossible mission force, and she laughs at him, because that's just an obviously fake name. I have to agree with her. It's kind of silly. And I like that the movie hangs a lantern on it, because it would have been weird if she took that seriously. But speaking of Michelle Monaghan, this movie does something interesting in that Ethan Hunt again has a love interest, but he's marrying this love interest, and this love interest is not involved in the business. And the love interest is introduced to us in a very interesting way, where we're starting in the middle of a very tense 24 style interrogation, where Ethan is disoriented, shot on a long lens that's shaking all over the place. Philip Seymour Hoffman is there, and there's another woman who's tied up, which is Michelle Monaghan. We don't know that it's his future wife or what any of the things are, but there's a lot of threatening that happens, shouting about rabbit's foot stuff, and then there's the threat of the gun going off, and then cut to the titles. And thankfully, Michael Giacchino worked on this one instead of Hans Zimmer, because I didn't like what Hans Zimmer did in the last one. And Michael Giacchino is very suited to this sort of task when it comes to the sort of bombastic 60s kind of throwback stuff. He has obviously proven himself time and time again with things like The Incredibles, etc. And his take on, you know, trying to make Star Trek music, as well as, I wouldn't say necessarily it was a throwback, but he tried to mimic John Williams' style. So he has a different sensibility than somebody like Hans Zimmer. So I think his action music works for the most part, and I like his take on the main score. The main theme. You get through these titles pretty quick, and then you're in the movie proper. But we're back in time at the start of all of this, where Ethan Hunt has his engagement party thing, and we're introduced to a cavalcade of people we'll never see again in the film.
Well, going back to that first scene for a moment, because we will see those people again and that entire scene again. What did you think of it? What were you feeling when you were watching that? Did you enjoy Philip Seymour Hoffman? Were you confused by his presence?
I mean, I knew he was the bad guy in a Mission Impossible movie, so it wasn't like...
Did you find him believable and or threatening?
I would say that the opening scene is cliched in terms of the bad guy dialogue and lines, like, oh, the thing, I'm going to do the thing now, I'm threatening, I'm going to kill this person, you know, counting down, like that whole thing. It's not a new or original thing. So it's not my favorite scene in this movie with Philip Seymour Hoffman, but he can do what is required with the cliche, that then he does it. So I was looking forward to seeing him do more things later on that we would get to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I very much enjoy Philip Seymour Hoffman in this movie. I enjoy him in general. And I think he sort of played against his typical type in this movie. And he was very serious and threatening. And even a lot of the physicality stuff, you know, when they're fighting later, I mean, albeit Ethan Hunt has a thing in his head or whatever, but I thought he was great in this movie.
Yeah, I don't think that was a fair fight.
Well, it's not supposed to be. He's the bad guy.
Yeah, I like Philip Seymour Hoffman has an interesting presence on screen. And he can, like you said, he's playing against what the roles were that he was kind of getting at the time. You know, he's the sort of bumbling Lebowski hench person, and he was in that that Ben Stiller, Jennifer Aniston movie.
Along Came Polly.
Yeah, and so he had an assortment of roles that he did in his career. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us, because I'm sure he would continue to do all kinds of crazy stuff. But
he did Capote right before this, which I didn't see, but that was another one for him.
Oh, I thought that was after this. But yeah, I didn't.
1 year before. Oh, well, Along Came Polly was 2 years before this. So yeah, he really needed to get out of that there.
This was definitely branching out. Speaking of branching out and playing something different, we had Felicity in here. So
Carrie Russell.
She's interesting. I thought that was a very interesting choice. And JJ likes to cast people that he's worked with before, and of course he worked with Carrie Russell on Felicity, the TV series. She would do this, and then later on go on to do a lot of other action-y kind of stuff, like The Americans and things. I found her to be capable, but we'll discuss that in a moment. Michelle Monaghan is enjoyable. I kind of wish we saw more of her doing things, I guess. And you got your Greg Grunfeld there at the party. And then just to let you know that everybody thinks Tom Cruise is dreamy but a little weird, he catches them, he lip reads the things that they're saying about him from the other room.
I mean, lest you think that he's fully retired and he's slipping in his age or whatever, no, he's still the spy. He's just sort of undercover spy because he can read lips and enjoy a conversation through a glass window, even if he can't hear people.
Yeah, and...
But he's deep undercover. He works for the DMV studying traffic patterns. And I do think of that line frequently. I don't know why, where he says, you tap the brakes one time, you can trace the effects for 200 miles.
It's an interesting line that did not stick with me.
But, well, next time you're stopped in traffic, you're going to think about that.
Yeah, I think a lot about, you know, braking in cars and waiting for that to have an effect on the traffic behind me. But... the listeners, I was rear-ended today by somebody who didn't stop at a traffic light, but anyway, it's neither here nor there. The party thing is interrupted by a phone call, and
a very long party scene, by the way. It's long. There's a lot of flavor to it. There's a lot of celebration. I guess they want you to know that this isn't just sort of like a passing fancy sort of thing. Like, this is Ethan's life. But then, of course, he does get... Well, he gets some... What's the goofy phone call? Like, we want to give you a free trip to Brazil or some crap. And he's like, oh, that must be... That's the new code for Would You Care for the Cinema of the Caribbean or something.
Yeah.
So he throws their bucket of ice out the back door and says, oh, we're out of ice. I got to run to the store and go get it. Don't worry about it, though. It'll be all right. And you would expect, being this Mission Impossible movie, that he would go find a payphone around the corner somewhere that has some special retina scanner in it and pick it up and dial and say, go secure. And they would be like, go for whatever. But no, he goes into the Circle K and Billy Crudup is there. And they like do the very typical spy thing where they don't look at each other. They just sort of talk over bags of Cheetos about a mission or something. And he gives them a little bit of the lowdown that... Kara Russell has been captured. You know, they're pals. He trained her. Well, you don't really see the full flashback training montage until a little bit later. But he's like, thought you'd be down for getting her back if you want. And he's like, nah, man, I'm out. It's my wedding party or whatever. So you have capable people handle that. He's like, all right, whatever, man. Flight leaves at 5 if you change your mind. And of course, Ethan has a sweaty nightmare.
You're forgetting
words.
The disposable camera.
Oh, of course I'm forgetting the disposable camera, because who cares? Like, it's the technology of the time, because there's always got to be a dossier. And he's like, take some pictures of your engagement thing, because you didn't invite me, LOL. And then he, like, taps a disposable camera on the end cap, and Ethan goes, oh, there's a nice rack focus there. And he's like, that must be a camera I need. So, of course he does, and that one has the retinal scanner in it. And he looks into the disposable camera and it says Ethan Hunt confirmed, and then shows some pictures and there's some voiceover, and it explains that she was tailing Owen Davian, who is Philip Seymour Hoffman, and he's a very bad guy and he sells bad things to all kinds of people around the world, and should be considered armed and dangerous, and she got captured. They were in this warehouse. They have a hostage. I'm pretty sure it's her.
Yeah, and we're also introduced to the team. In a similar way as we were in the previous, where it's like, here's the team that you're going to use. And we've got...
Did you get enough team in this one? You complained previously about team not being enough team.
I did get enough team. I do still kind of wish that maybe they were somewhere closer to the skill level that Tom Cruise's character seems to have. But
this, again, another thing that will change going forward in the movies, which I think you will enjoy, is that in this movie, you have your team of Ethan Hunt, you got Ving Rhames as Luther, then you've got the woman, and then you've got the skinny guy that flies the helicopter. That's the dynamic that was in the other movies, which is not super well balanced, but that's the team. And then you also have the sort of added wrinkle of Benji in the lab, which is Simon Pegg, who is going to get far more involved in the future. But in this one, he's an analyst, and he makes some Simon Pegg jokes about hard drives that caught on fire and stuff.
Yeah.
And then he tells a really weird, out-of-character story about a college professor, which is not at all forced and terrible.
Didn't appreciate it, but we...
It did not age well.
No, we will meet him later. For this part, he just... tells his wife, and he has this nightmare, and then he tells his wife in the middle of the night, oh yeah, I forgot to tell you about a business trip I had to go on.
The office called, well, during the party, I gotta go to Houston in the morning for a conference, and she's like, oh, so last minute, okay.
It's very strange. But then I feel like there would be more questions associated with that, like, why did she say that right now?
For things, but,
Yeah.
You know, maybe his job requires him to travel around to different states and tell them how to analyze their traffic better and stuff. So it's conceivable.
Yeah. They're
coming for the dogs.
No, that's the fire trucks. There's a lot of fire trucks. I don't know. Beverly Hills is probably burning down.
As long as the dogs are okay.
Yes. I can still hear the dog barking, so it's okay.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Is it a big dog or a little dog?
I can't see it because it's in another building.
Is it like a woof or like a woof?
I would say it was either a medium or smaller dog.
Okay. Mm-hmm. More of a woof.
Yeah. He's going on the mission, like in the other previous Mission Impossible movies, they kind of cut from continent to continent. And we are in Berlin. And they start setting up for their mission. They've got a tricked out truck with automated machine gun turrets on it. And I love the scene of Ving Rhames getting into the truck and then pushing a button that makes the keyboard raise up. And he does that like 5 times.
To have the appropriate ergonomics when you're manning autonomous machine guns with giant red trackballs.
This huge assortment of trackballs and raised keyboards. I wonder like what the ergonomic decision was for raising the keyboards. They just wanted it to look more technical or something. It's very strange. But
that's how you know the guns are activated.
Yeah. And they're setting up for their mission. Everybody's got a task to do. And you've got Ethan breaking into the building, and he's got explosive charges to lay, and he's going through and doing his thing. And you see how the charges work, and he sets it off and gets Carrie Russell. She is a little worse for wear, so he injects her with adrenaline so that she wakes right up and they can run out of the building together. Unfortunately,
this is an extended action sequence. So I mean, we're really hitting the bullet points of what happens here. But I would like to say that I very much enjoy the action directing in this movie, of which there is a lot. I think 80% of this movie is action sequences, and I think they're done well. So they don't wear on me particularly. But I am curious if you enjoy them. There is a lot of excessively long anamorphic lenses with a lot of foreground staging depth stuff. I mean, most people will like they'll put like something between a character and the lens, so there's a little bit of foreground schmutz or whatever. This one probably has like 4 layers of stuff before you even get to the character you're supposed to be looking at, so like everything is like 120mm lens or something. So I don't know if that wore on you or if you did you were actually able to appreciate a lot of the action sequences.
I didn't super love it. I mean, but, you know, I'd take this over John Woo any day of the week. But
yeah, it is worth mentioning that this is a 2006 film and things were starting to get gritty. I mean, we mm-hmm. weren't quite into gritty Batman. Well, maybe we were. Did we have Batman Begins?
I think it was 2007, if memory serves, because the same year as Iron Man, I think.
Batman Begins was 2005, so they had begun the grittiness of the decade. And then, you know, was it 2008 or whatever before we got Dark Knight? Where we go full gritty, but yeah, you know, this is of a time. So not only is the directing and the camera work gritty, there's a lot of grain in the grade of this.
Oh my
god, really high contrast, low saturation in here.
The grade of this bothered me more than anything else. It's like we have highs that we've kicked up a little, and then we've got mids that we kicked up a little and gammaed down on, and then we took all of the black and low shadow tones and crush them to the floor so that it's just grain. And I don't understand necessarily the impulse to do that. Maybe the transfer for home video is not as wonderful as it would be if I was watching this in a theater, but it is.
I think it was just the look of the time, and it's one of those things that has necessarily gone out of vogue a bit.
I appreciate that he was doing his thing, but I think it's distracting, especially you don't wind up getting a sense of character of place of time of day, really, a lot of the time, because everything's always so crushed and the highs are always a little clippy. It kind of makes it seem weirdly similar. And with the long lenses and the handheld camera work, it starts to get a little strobey in some of the action stuff, and distracting mainly in the dialogue scenes where characters are talking to one another on extremely long lenses, and you're watching what is basically like micro movements of the camera operator's hand adjusting, causing the camera to bounce up and down. It's really something that I think they went a little overboard on. I'm not saying every shot needed to be a lock off or anything, but just like, would it have killed you for like a little tiny itty bitty bit of, you know, something to mount the camera on that wasn't a human being?
Yeah, it's a very dramatic action movie. It was a style of a time, they're gonna tone it down. Like, it's also worth noting that, like, in terms of grittiness, this is the year before Die Hard 4. We're talking about trying out some crazy grades, so I think things were happening. People were trying stuff, and then we sort of came to our senses a little bit.
Yeah, but you know, overall, these are things that I would give as notes. please adjust. But I don't outright reject the movie because of the creative decisions. I just don't agree with them because I don't think it really it doesn't strongly interfere with my enjoyment of it. But this action scene keeps going, and they jump onto the truck, and they drive out of there. There's an explosion. They are like, yay, we got to our helicopter. And then the bad guys have a helicopter, but it's like, I don't know, what is that, an Apache or something? Like, I don't know.
It's like an Apache or some sort. It's one of them skinny ones. It's got lots of missiles on the side.
Yeah, they have an attack helicopter, and our guys have a news camera helicopter, they take off and they fly through the wind turbine fields that they have, I guess in Berlin, although, you know, I have no idea if this was just like some of this B-roll was some of the Palm Springs ones, but
that would be my assumption.
Yeah, they fly through.
Oh yeah, look at that, Palm Springs.
I had a feeling. But they fly through these things, and it's actually pretty interesting to watch maneuvering two helicopters through these apparently tight spaces, and you have the tension of these fan blades, wind turbine fan blades spinning. So you don't necessarily know as they get closer, you know, if they're going to hit. And because they shot this all on like really long lenses, you get a very compressed, you get really compressed space. So it feels like they're a lot closer to all of these wind turbines that are in front of and behind them. I did appreciate that. I thought this was put together reasonably well for building that dramatic tension, because our guys don't have any fancy anti-aircraft stuff, because they kind of weren't expecting there to be an attack helicopter.
Don't they literally shoot like a boat flare gun at it?
Yeah, they fire their flare gun to deter one of the homing missiles. During this process, they also discover that there is an explosive implant in Carrie Russell's head. Now, for those of us who watched the beginning of the movie, we know that there was talk of an explosive implant, but we don't necessarily know like how explosive, and will they be able to defuse it? And so they settle on trying to use a defibrillator to overload the electronics of the explosive, but they got to build the charge in this portable defibrillator before they can use it, and unfortunately the time runs out, and you just see Carrie Russell's eyeball do a weird thing, and then her head jerks to the side. It's pretty sad because she seemed interesting. She was capable of running and gunning, even though she had been beat to crap. And it was somebody that had a personal connection to Ethan Hunt, so it made you want to root for her to continue on. And also,
they had a plan. They knew what they were doing. They were reacting in the moment. They thought they had it beat, but then, you know, of course, the ticking clock. 30 seconds to charge a defibrillator. My God, a little bit much.
But they also managed to destroy the pursuing helicopter by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers doing some fancy flying, where he maneuvered their helicopter through a gap in the fans, the wind turbine spinning, and the other attack helicopter tried to pursue but got too close and then hit the thing and it exploded, and there were sheep. Who were alarmed. I thought that was actually pretty reasonably well done. And I should say, all of the information that I have about this movie currently is from either my eyeballs seeing the movie, you telling me things, or the podcast that I listened to with Todd, where he went on Light the Fuse?
Light the Fuse.
Light the Fuse podcast, which is the one that Stu Mashewitz had been on the other week, which is why you started this whole thing. We didn't know Todd was going to be on. Academy Award winner, Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Todd Vasiri.
But he hasn't won an Academy Award yet, as far as we're aware.
Didn't Star Wars get a thing? Anyway, I think they were nominated. Anyway.
It's an honor just to be nominated, to be honest. I'm glad you listened to the Toddcast, because that was good. I liked the Toddcast. There's another half of it coming out at some point.
Yeah, but that's for a movie I haven't seen yet, so I wasn't like feeling like I really missed out.
Right. He covered pretty much all of three, everything he was going to say about three in that episode.
Yeah, so that was the important part for my listening purposes. So listeners, if you want to actually hear like information, I suggest you can go listen to that. Because one of the things that I learned is that they used a lot of miniatures for the helicopter stuff here, for exploding wind turbines and things, which is not something you see very often, and is nice. It's nice. It's real nice. I liked it. I liked what they did. I did not think that they really blew up a wind turbine, of course, but I like what they did with the miniatures pulling that off. I think they managed to achieve the effect that they were going after, which made it look like they had a big explosion. But of course, I guess it really helps when you can't see any detail at all.
the dark environment, high contrast, long lensy stuff. I mean, all of the styles played together nicely.
Yeah. It was certainly well integrated. But then they cut back to them returning from their mission at the headquarters, and we've got Billy Crudup again, and we've got Lawrence Fishburne, who seems to be the guy who's in charge of Billy Crudup. Anthony Hopkins is not featured in this one, or the other head guy from the first movie. There seems to be a real revolving door going on at this company. This agency. There is a debriefing where Lawrence Fishburne basically gives them crap for their handling of the scenario and how there's an agent who's dead and they didn't capture any of the other people, so now they don't have any leads on what they could do. And Ethan Hunt's like, well, that wasn't the mission briefing. We were supposed to do this thing. The meeting does not end well, and Ethan is very angry. And he's on kind of like a personal vendetta thing. And so they go talk to Simon Pegg, who's got the destroyed hard drives. And he's like trying to recover stuff from the hard drives. And they found he finds an email about the Vatican for that Owen will be attending a thingy at the Vatican. And so they decide that he's
going to be purchasing something codenamed the Rabbit's Foot for $800-something million, and they know where he's going to be for the first time. Because there was a big whole thing about how Davian is a ghost, and he's hard to find, and he's a bad guy, and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, aha, we have a lead now. We know where he's going to be and when he's going to be there, because we've got hard drive.
Got a hard drive email. See, he should have. It's the perils of having your own personal email server, or downloading, I guess. But
yeah, you don't need offline. You should just use a Chromebook. Everything's in the cloud.
No, yeah, or just put it on a super secret server and mark it as top secret, and then nobody will find it. But
oh dear, it's not even funny anymore.
I don't know what else to do. I'm so tired. My emotions are all over the place. But the
I don't have nearly enough mellow corn left.
Mm-hmm. Luther and Ethan talk about this, and they decide that they're going to go on this mission themselves, so as to not get anyone else in trouble.
Tell nobody because of plausible deniability, because, you know, this is a very important mission, so we can't tell the boss.
Just seems like a bad idea, but in this case, it was a good idea. But they decide to use the same team from Berlin, and they get everybody back together. They get the gang back together, and they're going to go in and do their impossible missioning. And they decide that the best way to break in is to, like, stage a car breakdown with the DHL truck, and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is there to, like, do the fake thing to distract people while Ethan scales the walls of the Vatican. And then once that's over, he drives off, and you've got Zen driving in the Lamborghini Murcielago, it was a Murcielago, right?
I believe it was a Gallardo.
Oh, Gallardo. Okay. Anyway,
the tiny one,
the tacky one. And so,
it's not tacky. It's beautiful. I saw a baby blue one of those driving around in your neck of the woods one time when I was there, and it was very pretty.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a lot of fancy cars over here in Fancy Carville. But
you got your Lamborghinis, you got your Civics. What else?
You have the whole range, really. You got Saturn Ions. But they don't go through the whole thing of, like, explaining the full setup of what they're doing, like they have done in previous movies where they've been like, this is how the heist is going to happen.
Yeah, they're like, we're going to go get him. We're going to nab him because he's ungettable, and he's going to be buying a bad thing. We don't know what the bad thing is because the hard drives are thrashed, but we're going to go get him.
Yeah, I do like that the bad thing, the rabbit's foot, is a MacGuffin.
You actually like that? Doesn't bother you?
No, I like it because, honestly, I don't need the thing to actually do anything. It just needs to be the thing for them to fight over. Just like the original MacGuffin, just like the original, you know, what was that Alfred Hitchcock movie where he's just like, yeah, you know, they're stealing this thing and nobody knows what it is. It doesn't matter. It's not the point of the story. It's all about what they're doing. And I like doing that with Mission Impossible because, so far, we've had money stuff and agency lists, and we've had the super virus that was going to kill everybody. And so this could be, like, anything, but it doesn't matter what it does because we never see it do the thing. And if you say that it's a thing that does the thing, then you got to show it doing the thing and explain how the mechanics of the thing work. And they just cut all that right out of the movie, and they're just like, no, this is just something you're going to fight over.
Well, except for Simon Pegg's speech, which is, I don't know, it's meant to sort of reinforce that we're supposed to take it seriously. He's like, you know, my professor had a theory that eventually mankind would undo itself by accidentally inventing something that would destroy all mankind. And anytime I see somebody willing to spend $800 million on some sort of unproven technology, I always assume it's going to be one of those things that could kill everybody. It's like, well, they should have had Ethan and Luther just say, thanks for that, but no, we're cool.
I hated that whole thing. I don't think it...
It was very long.
I don't think it helped at all, and it seemed so, so out of the blue. Like, there was no, like, pieces of the puzzle that connected to him saying that. It was just like, well, it's something we don't know what it is, so it's got to be this thing that will end all life. And it's like, but...
Yeah.
I said, what is it?
And he's like, I don't know, but I have this theory. At the end, Luther should have just gone like, so you don't know. You could have just said, I don't know. Like,
you didn't have to make up stuff.
Yeah, but, you don't have to make up stories to freak everybody out. Just say, I don't know.
but I do like it's a MacGuffin that we don't know what's going on. But we've got them setting up their thing. You don't know how things are going to necessarily play out other than how he was going to get into the building. And they break in through this elaborate thing of breaking down a wall to get to the thing to go to the. It's fun to watch the mechanics of this process happen, but I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's necessarily the easiest way to break in.
The Vatican entry scene.
Yeah, you know where
you got the yelling in the Italian. You got mm-hmm. the fake smoke coming out of the hood of the car. It delightfully stereotypes Italians as just wanting to yell at each other and argue, and then everything's hunky dory or whatever.
Yeah. But I mainly mean when you know they're going through and they're blowing up the wall to set up their little thing, but and then they do the face printer. Which you had alluded to. You had mentioned that it existed.
Yeah,
and for some reason I had put that out of my mind until I watched the scene. I was like, oh yeah, Dan said that there was a face printer, and there it is. Printing faces.
I thought that they did a pretty good job of like they tried to hide it, you know, going back and forth using the back of Luther's head as a wipe between like when the mask was real and when it was actually Philip Seymour Hoffman. But I thought they hit it well because you know they did the voice thing, so he was still Ethan for a while, and then when they were like tapping in the last little bits of his like his eye crease areas, and then like once he had finished pushing those in, then it was officially Philip Seymour Hoffman, and you could tell when it was like fully transitioned. But I thought they did a great job with that, and especially for 2006. I liked it a lot.
It was interesting. I still think this is just hilarious face stuff. But they use the face printer to do this. But we also get a sense of how they do the voice thingy. They still have that little piece of voice tape that you put over your larynx. I guess it mm-hmm. electrically shocks your larynx to make the sounds that someone else would make or something.
Speaking, it's just it's all just vibration. So it's gonna do a diff. It's gonna recalibrate your vibrations to make you sound like Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is pretty cool. I would do that.
It gives you those good vibrations. But in order to do that, you gotta get like an audio sample. And because they don't know anything about this guy, they have to actually capture him and get an audio sample first.
Yeah, he has to read a limerick into a microphone.
Yeah, I like how Zen goes up and spills the wine on the guy, which is a classic move. Classic move to send him to make him go to the bathroom. And the shot of him leaning over the sink, trying to wipe out the red wine, and then he starts to sit up a little, straighten up a little, and the camera moves, and you see that there's another Philip Seymour Hoffman behind Philip Seymour Hoffman, and spins around, and you get that panic from him as he fights himself. I thought that worked really well. Then he tries to compel him to read the limerick. He gets the limerick read. So that you do the voice thing, and they're trying to upload the voice thing. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is there, and he like hauls the incapacitated Philip Seymour Hoffman off to the side. The bodyguard comes in to check, but the thing hasn't uploaded yet, so he's got to pretend to be clearing his throat for like 30 seconds as he continues to rinse. And then the bodyguard, you can finally talk to the bodyguard and say that he's fine. And he makes his way out of there. What I don't understand is if you have this bad guy who is so bad, why not capture the bad guy who is bad?
What do you mean? They do capture him.
Oh, no, but I mean, what? It feels like they take a long time.
To do what part?
I don't know. Because then they go back in and then they get the briefcase thing, but I guess they needed to do all these steps in order to get rabbit's foot thing, too.
The point of mimicking him is to hop in the Lambo and hand off the briefcase through the sewer grate and fake his death so that everyone thinks that Owen Davian is dead. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert, doesn't last very long because somebody who is on the wrong side gets wind that Davian is still alive. So their plan was kind of for naught, but it was a good plan to fake his death and then capture him and then try and figure out what he was doing.
Yeah, and I like how they managed to pull this off, capture the guy, and you still know where things are going to wind up because you watch the beginning of the movie. So there's not so much of a sense of victory about what they're doing. There's a sense of dread of like, well,
This is going to go wrong at some point, but when?
Yeah, when does this go sideways? And the answer is very shortly after this, because Ethan reports to Lawrence Fishburne that they have captured the bad guy, and they got the rabbit's foot thingy, and or at least the suitcase with the rabbit's foot thingy description. And so they're on their way back, and he asks Billy Crudup if Billy Crudup knew about this, and Billy Crudup says, "Oh, yeah, of course." Now,
that's the whole point of plausible deniability. You don't need to know about it until it succeeds, and then once it succeeds, you can know about it.
Yeah, or, you know, you can just seem suspicious. But so they head back to, where was it? They're going across the Chesapeake Bay bridge, and...
I would like to point out one thing that is it kind of breaks continuity a little bit, but when they open the floor of the Lamborghini to hand the thing through the sewer, and Vingram says, "What's up?" and he goes, "Nothing. What's up with you?" That is absolutely not a thing that Ethan Hunt would ever say, but it's Philip Seymour Hoffman just sort of like being jokey, and I love it. I enjoyed it. It made me laugh.
Yeah, it was fun. So they're crossing the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. They're in a big motorcade. Philip Seymour Hoffman is captured inside of an armored prison transport thing, and everybody else is in cars. And Ethan gets a call from Simon Pegg, who's decoded the microdot, the magnetically encoded microdot that he got on a postcard from Berlin earlier. We didn't mention it, but it happened. It's brief. It's not something you particularly think about very much, but this is the moment where it comes into play, because it's a video, and the video is Carrie Russell saying that she thinks that Lawrence Fishburne's character is in on this, and that he's the traitor to them. And this is when everybody panics, because obviously they're in a situation where the person that could betray them is going to be in an advantageous position to betray them. It does happen. There is an explosion. There is a predator drone thing flying around. A helicopter full of fully suited up black military or mercenary guys comes into play. Start shooting up everybody and blowing the crap out of everything. Ethan Hunt is in this car accident. He's got to get out of there. Luther tells him that there's a thingy in the back of the thingy, so he's got to go, but there's a hole in the bridge, so he's got to run around to the side.
Man.
The bad guys
rifle?
See that there's... No, I'm not familiar with the G36 rifle. Apparently it comes in 36 pieces, because he's got to spend like 5 minutes putting that thing together. The predator drone swings back around, but he's able to shoot down the predator drone. The predator drone does manage to blow up some more stuff. When he hits the predator drone, it smacks into the thingy and blows up the other thingy. And it's a big deal, but now he's out of bullets, because he sprayed and prayed at the predator drone earlier. So he can't take out Philip Seymour Hoffman before he can get away. It's a big, tense scene.
I like how Felix Seymour Hoffman just kind of like stares at him from the helicopter, sort of unemotionally. He's like, I'm a bad guy. This is what I do. I'm familiar with the idea of all of this going down.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman had threatened Ethan's wife or girlfriend or whatever earlier when they were talking, and so now that he knows his name's Ethan and there's a traitor working on their side, he knows that he can get the information about how to obtain Ethan's loved ones. And so Ethan tries to call home. His wife-to-be is not there. She is at work at the ER or something. She's in a wing of the hospital. They have the tension of her just going about her day while you know that someone's out to get her, and Ethan's trying to get there as fast as possible. He abducts a car, absconds with a car, and arrives at the hospital, runs through the hospital like a maniac, can't find her, and exits to be surrounded by a bunch of IMF guys and things who were like, you got to come in. Come in now.
We got to take you in for questioning. And of course, he had just gotten a call from Davian saying like, hey, buddy, got your wife. You got 48 hours to get the thing or I'm going to kill her. So chop, chop. Call me back when you got the thing.
Yeah. And so I like the part where he's like, I saw that you had a watch on earlier, so prepare to set your time. Yeah. And
this is before the days of, smartphones with clocks and stuff. So
yeah. Can you just imagine how frustrating it'd be? Like, hey, bleep, set a 48 hour timer. And it'd be like, I'm sorry, setting a 48 second timer. And it'd be like, no, you did it wrong. But that would add a different level of tension to the movie because your timer would be off.
They could share a doodle or whatever for when when they were both available to have the call.
That would be entertaining. But they, this Ethan's freaked out and he tries to run away from the IMF guys. They tase him. He goes down and then he wakes up strapped to a gurney with a mouth thingy covering his mouth. So
a leather muzzle like that would really do a lot for a human.
Because he's Hannibal Lecter, obviously. But there's a scene with Lawrence Fishburne.
I mean, later he does bite Billy Crudup, so I guess it worked.
That's true, I guess. Maybe he has a history of biting people that they knew about, but
it's in his managerial file. That's why they know. They're like, when you tie this guy down, he's going to bite you, so muzzle.
Yeah, but Lawrence Fishburne is there, and he's like, I capture you. You're the only one who knew, and you were doing this mission off the books, and so blah, 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 blah. Lawrence Fishburne's character's reasonings don't really hold up a lot, but watching the scene, you can only help but conclude he's not the traitor, because the traitor wouldn't capture him and try to keep Ethan Hunt from doing the thing that needs to be done in 48 hours. The traitor would get him out, and indeed, Billy Crudup is the one who offers Ethan a way to get out. And some people in the audience might assume, oh, that's so nice of Billy Crudup, like Ethan does, but everybody else would be like, oh, of course it's the guy who's going to let you out of here so that you can go do the thing, because they want the thing.
He's the direct manager, and he's got a more personal relationship with Ethan, so he knows that Ethan's wife is very important, and, go rescue your wife. We'll sort all this stuff out on Monday when you get back, and, do what you do, and then we'll deal with all the paperwork afterwards, so it's okay. Yeah. I'm gonna set you free by giving you a key fob-looking thing.
Yeah, well, it turns out it's like a tiny knife, and... So they wheel the gurney into the elevator. There's four guys in there, I think. Four or five?
Four, maybe.
And Ethan uses the little knife thingy to break his bonds so that he can headbutt a guy and punch the other guy and then cut himself free and then kick and punch and stuff, and he gets out of there. And he is capable of making his way back to get all the stuff in order, and then he can contact Luther. And they can get the information about what they need to do, and they need to go to Shanghai, cut to Shanghai. And you have a scene not unlike previous movies where they need to break into a skyscraper. And Ethan Hunt says, okay, so just, go in from the roof. See also previous movie.
it's kind of great because I think they play this well, because you're like, this plan is ludicrous, and basically everyone in the room is saying that too, but he's like, first of all, shut up. We have 2 hours before they're going to kill my wife, which is like, oh God, you guys are, it took you 46 hours to escape and get to Shanghai? Like, ugh, geez. But he's like, he's freaking out. He's like, first plan, I'm going to jump off of this roof and land on that roof. They're like, there's got to be a better way. He's like, nope, don't have time to think of a better way. Let's do this. Ready, set, go. Although they apparently did have time to stop off at Sports Authority or whatever and buy a baseball pitch machine for that particular part of it. He's just like a
specific piece of gear to pick up in Shanghai.
I got storage for everything over there, so I could see it. There's probably a 24-hour like batting cage or something they could go pick one up there. But they make their way over, and he's gonna swing from one side to the other. And it's cool. Tom Cruise gets to do a thing where he jumps off the building with a harness on. It's dramatic, and I think they do a good job of really emphasizing the tension here, to the point that they don't even bother showing the break-in. Like, once he's inside the building, like, they don't cut there. They hang out with the folks in the van who are like, oh God, he's only got like 6 minutes or whatever till they shoot his wife. So he's got to hurry up. And then you can tell he's panicking because he radios and says, I can't get to the roof to parachute off. So I'm just going to jump out this first window that I got here and do my best not to die as I parachute down. And, you know, there's chaos. He gets tangled. He smashes into another building and he's like laying on a desk. And then he makes sure he still has the thing, the canister or whatever. There's a big biohazard thing on it. And then there's a janitor there who like makes a face at him and they catch eyes right before his parachute catches some air again and it yanks him back out the window. And then he falls down into the road and he drops the thing and it's rolling through traffic and et cetera. It's like there's a lot of action, a lot of action.
Yeah. And they're also like 14 more insert shots of cars between Ethan and the canister than there needed to be.
Very long lens and a lot of running and darting and zigzagging and, you know.
Yeah, but he gets the thingy and the van and so they're on their way and then they can't get cell phone reception and trying to evade.
Yeah, that's the other fun thing. You're in Shanghai. I think they would probably have cell phone reception in the city, but what do I know?
I don't know. It was a different time. Maybe.
It was 2006.
Yeah. Back then it was still like Edge. It was still like the big one, GSM
Edge.
That's
a fair point. Yeah. Maybe he forgot to pay his international data rates or whatever, too. So he was like permanently stuck on like 2G or, well, Edge is 2G, right? So
yeah.
Was there a 1G?
Yeah. Let's not dissect the cellular options that were available to Tom Cruise.
Available with his flip Nokia phone. It wasn't Nokia. It was kind of nondescript. It looked like a Sony Ericsson or one of those goofy ones that they slip into a Bond movie from time to time, but I don't remember seeing anything on it in particular.
Yeah, I don't know. But they make the call. They arrange the thing. They're going to meet up, and he has to come alone. You know, like all great things. And he comes alone and bad things happen to him, and then we're at the beginning of the movie.
He's captured. Oh, it is a Nokia cell phone. This is cool. I want one of these.
Sure. Just put it in the drawer with all the other cell phones.
Yeah, I'll put it with all my other cell phones and my beeper. I still got my beeper in there.
She just have a little cell phone museum.
I kind of do. There was a point in time where I put my, I don't think it's still out. I had my pager and my original Nokia little unbreakable candy bar thing were on a shelf, but they just kept getting dusty, so I put them away.
Oh. Bummer. Well, you need to get those like museum Lucite boxes to put around it.
Oh, sure. That's what I need to do. Memorialize them all.
Mm-hmm.
At least the iPhones are in their boxes, so like that's easy to dust. Although an iPhone is probably pretty easy to dust by itself, too, because there's no keys.
I heard they're going to fail because they don't have a keyboard. But
mm-hmm.
how can you win over BlackBerry users? But
they love their keyboard and that little scroll wheel thing on the side.
Yeah, and the Pearl had that nubbin.
Oh, the little thing in the middle. Yeah, yeah. The little ball.
Yeah, but so anyway, we're
sucked
at the beginning of the movie now, and things didn't go well, and he's going to shoot the wife, and he shoots the wife, and Tom Cruise is all upset. Philip Seymour Hoffman leaves, and he's like, you didn't get the rabbit's foot. And Billy Crudup comes in, and he's all like, yeah, you know, sorry about that. Your wife's still alive. There's plausible deniability. You just need to tell me where the rabbit's foot thing is, and we can get started on that.
He's basically like, this thing is a biological weapon, so we couldn't just like open the canister to verify that you brought us the right thing, so we had to make you believe we were shooting your wife in order to make sure you weren't lying to us.
Mm-hmm.
And congratulations, you didn't lie. And now you need to tell us what was on the micro dot. And he's like, you know, he's finally sort of coming to it, like, no, I need to talk to my wife first or whatever. And he does the whole what's the name of the lake trivia crap from the party where he was lip reading everyone like a weirdo to verify that she is, in fact, still alive. I didn't really need Billy Crudup to say, no, this was Davian's assistant that failed him at the Vatican. Remember when he pulled the duct tape off her mouth? Like, we don't care. It could have been literally anybody. Davian is killing lots of people because he doesn't care. Like, it doesn't need to be anything in particular
no,
tied to the rest of the story.
Mission Impossible just likes their face mask gags.
No, they could have done the face mask. It could have just been like, yeah, we just grabbed this lady and killed her because it's your fault.
Yeah. It's weird.
Because we're bad.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, Ethan headbutts Billy Crudup and breaks out of this situation that he's in. Takes down a lot of people on the way out of there. And he calls up Simon Pegg and has him do a trace on the last number that this phone called.
I guess they didn't have, the call protection apps that we have now.
No, I mean, data privacy was not something people were really thinking about at the time, but, Simon Pegg is able to punch up the location history of the other cell phone. And he's able to figure out that, it called a phone that was, a couple blocks away. So, you know, Tom Cruise running through the streets, and he gets over to the other place, breaks into that, beats up all the guards, gets to his wife, and frees her, but then the charge starts to go off in his head. So he's incapacitated a little. He suffers through his pain and explains to her how to operate the gun.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is there, don't forget. And he's like, aha, I triggered the charge in her head. You got 4 minutes left. I'm going to beat you up and I'm going to kill your wife in front of you because I told you I was going to do that before. And he gets some good licks in. But Tom Cruise sees his sad wife there tied up and he can't abide it. He musters within him the strength to defeat Philip Seymour Hoffman and fight him back. And then they go rolling out into the road. Ugh. And, you know, you knew he had to kill Philip Seymour Hoffman in this movie. It couldn't be just something as simple as just like shooting him because that would be too anticlimactic. But, you know, they do that thing where they're like, you know, rolling out into the road and then there's a truck coming in and he does a roll back and then lifts him up. So Philip Seymour Hoffman goes face first into the grill of a large truck and he just hangs out underneath the bumper and it drives over top. Kind of like, you know, Edge of Tomorrow, what he tries to do. And then misses a couple of times.
I thought that this was actually not my favorite ending for a villain. I thought that they had such a thing going on that it felt kind of weird that he just got a truck in the face.
You wanted to see him get captured like the Joker, and that they were going to live on fighting for the rest of their days?
Well, no. Just wanted him to have more comeuppance in a way that seems specific to the situation. The truck just makes it seem like an accident, which I'm not as huge of a fan of. But
I mean, if you're in Shanghai dealing with a bad guy, having it look like an accident to everybody is probably a good thing for him. But yeah, you know, he probably could have made him suffer a little bit more.
Yeah, but he goes back to his wife, explains the gun, and says that she's going to have to electrocute him.
Yeah, I would have explained the charge in the brain first before I explained the gun personally, but whatever. You do what you got to do.
Yeah, and fortunately she has some medical expertise because of earlier character moments involving her. So we know that she's at least going to be pretty capable of bringing him back, but a little skeptical about this firearm situation initially. So she electrocutes him. There's a nice shot of him biting through the wood, like bit that he put in his mouth to keep him from, you know, crushing his teeth.
Good.
He flies backwards and, she tries to bring him back, but, she's interrupted by more bad henchmen that come in. And so she has to actually try to shoot them. And she does a very good job for this not being something that she's good at. Billy Crudup makes the unfortunate decision that he's gonna, you know, personally intervene on this one, and he gets a torso full of bullets from future Mrs. Ethan Hunt.
A torso full of bullets is a good description.
Yeah,
and he's shocked, and then he falls down and his briefcase falls open and the rabbit's foot is in there.
Yeah. But then, Ethan has survived. They got the charge out of his head. And then they do a weird, rom-com style walk out of there, like nothing had happened. They're just, you know, walking by the water. And this is where they have the thing about the, you know, I want to tell you I do this thing and I work for the IFF. And she's like, I don't know what that
reasonable questions. She's like, why are we in China and what just happened? Who are all of these people trying to kill us? What, like, I have questions.
Mm-hmm. Very reasonable. Yeah. And so they leave it there, basically, is like, there's a phone call from Lawrence Fishburne, who you know, is happy with him now, because the plot no longer requires.
He sees him in person back in the States at the office. He's like, mm-hmm. you know, sorry for everything I put you through. Don't quit on us. Just enjoy your honeymoon vacation, and then we'll talk when you get back. And he's like, I don't know, man. I'm looking forward to getting out on my own and living life and being happy with my wife and stuff. So I don't know if I'll be back. You know, thanks for believing me and stuff now. And Michelle Monaghan's over there saying hi to Luther and everybody. And she's like, oh, look how great everybody is here. This is nice. I'm glad he has some nice coworkers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then they run down the hall hand in hand, smiling, laughing on their way to their honeymoon. And then the credits roll,
mm-hmm.
which is a little weird.
It was a very strange way to end this.
It really makes you think that they... I can't tell if they thought there was going to be another one or not, because if they didn't think there was going to be another one, maybe they would have gone about it a different way. Because this is, don't forget, this is 2006. This is gritty, dark reboot time. I mean, they could have killed everybody. They could have, like, you know, ended it. But they sailed him off into the sunset happy with his new wife. So I don't know what that really portends for the future of the series if you are planning it out.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I mean, I know what happened afterward, but you don't know yet. What did you think of the ending?
I mean, I just said I didn't find it entirely satisfying. I do like that it didn't end like a bad Pierce Brosnan James Bond movie like the previous movie did. And I think I like the ending of the first one where you know that there are missions that he will be going on, which will be impossible.
Yeah. Were you expecting that there would be like a scene of him on his honeymoon where they like sent him a mission and he was like, oh God, I'm back in it again.
Yeah. I thought it was out, but they pulled me back in. I mean, I think it would have been, it just seemed a weird spot. Basically, it is like we don't see him married, which is that this wedding was like a big deal. So it's kind of like open ended, but I don't know. I haven't seen the next one, so I don't know how. Maybe it feels more satisfying if you have some more context. But if I just watching this one in isolation, you know, it's not the best ending. But I'd rather have this, you know, slightly like weaker, mediocre, whimpering ending of like things just sort of puttering out than the ending of the previous one where I was just annoyed at how it ended. This doesn't irritate me. It's just kind of like not as exciting. It doesn't seem to be up to the level of the previous parts of this film.
Yeah. Yeah. But then again, on the whole, this movie is like a massive... like three action set pieces with a little bit of plot sprinkled in, the only thing of consequence is that Ethan got married, and then they threatened his wife, and he got her back. But other than that, like, you know, the plot could be literally anything, and it doesn't really make a difference. It's just a lot of action, and they did it well, and yeah. Somehow it managed to be 2 hours and 5 minutes long. But you know, I think you'll get a little bit more satisfaction. About this movie in the future movies because they do kind of keep the storyline ish going. They don't just go like, remember the previous movies? Pretend that didn't happen anymore. We're just doing another one now. Like they actually kind of sort of try to build off of them going forward. Because I think maybe after three, they're like, well, maybe this is going to be a thing and we should make them coherent with one another rather than just like Tom Cruise is there and Ving Rhames is there. And other than that, everything else is just nonsense that we add for the sake of adding it, which gets a little old after a while.
Yeah, which is why I kind of, you know, I had been annoyed that they had a team that they destroyed in the first one. and they didn't really walk away with a solid team from the second one. This one sort of builds a little bit of a thing, but you know, it's hardly a situation where everybody's working together on future projects by the end of this film.
Well, you know, they do have their formula. The formula is one thing that they work on, but they never really break out of. With, you know, you got Ethan, you got Luther, you got the woman, you got the guy, and then you got Benji. And that's kind of how it goes from here on out. But, you know, they do a little better job going forward. But I'm glad you didn't hate this one. It seems like you didn't hate it. And it's only up for Mission Impossible 2 is what I tried to get you to hold on for. So I think we're doing a little better, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like I said, I don't hate this movie. I had some notes of creative differences, but like, what do I know?
We're no J.J. Abrams.
No, if only. But I think that this is a much more successful movie that seems to get more things right than I feel like the previous two movies did. I like the shot blocking, composition, tension building stuff of the first movie, and sort of the very clear delineations of how you progress in terms of the action set piece, then some talking, then another action set piece. Whereas this one, it feels a little more even and constant and rapid fire. It's still a modern action movie that makes you feel like you are seeing something that is entertaining. You got your money's worth, I think, out of this if you had bought a movie ticket to see it at the time, which I did not.
Because you had had enough of these impossible missions.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I completely forgot about this. Trapped in the Closet controversy. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I just saw that. I was scrolling through some IMDb trivia in an attempt to find anything about the ending, and I stopped right on that one. Go ahead, read it for the audience.
I don't know. Okay, fine. A blog entry of HollywoodInterrupted.com in March 2006 alleged that Viacom of Paramount and Comedy Central canceled the rebroadcast of the South Park episode Trapped in the Closet due to threats by crews to refuse to participate in the Mission Impossible 3 publicity circle. These assertions were soon also reported by E! News and American Morning. Fox News attributed threats from crews stating to back out of his Mission Impossible 3 promotional duties if Viacom didn't pull a repeat of the episode. As evidence of bad blood between Cruise and Viacom, the Washington Post reported that South Park fans struck back into March 2006 and threatened to boycott Mission Impossible 3 until Comedy Central put Trapped in the Closet back on its schedule. Melissa McNamara of CBS News later questioned whether this boycott hurt the film's box office debut. Political blogger Andrew Sullivan encouraged a boycott of the film based on claims that Cruise allegedly forced Comedy Central to censor a South Park episode about Scientologists. Make sure you don't go see Paramount's Mission Impossible 3, Cruise's upcoming movie, Sullivan wrote. I know you weren't going to see it anyway, but now any money you spend on his movie is a blow against the freedom of speech. Boycott it. Tell your friends to boycott it. Andrew, when asked in ABC's primetime about his involvement with stopping the episode of rebroadcast on Comedy Central, Cruise stated, "First of all, could you ever imagine sitting down with anyone? ? I would never sit down with someone and question them on their beliefs. Period. Here's the thing, : I'm not even going to dignify this. I honestly didn't really even know about it. I'm working making my movie. I've got my family. I'm busy. I don't spend my days going, what are people saying about me? ? A representative of Cruise had also denied any involvement of Cruise with the issue, specifically responding to Cruise's allegations of a reputed corporate power play.
Hmm. That's fun.
I'm glad everybody had a good time.
I did not realize Joe Carnahan was working on this film before quitting over creative differences, and it was handed off to JJ.
I don't think I know who that is. I saw that David Fincher worked on something.
Well, they said they were going to give it to him afterward, but he went on to do something else. He's the guy who did Smokin' Aces and The A-Team and Narc.
Didn't see any of those.
As a writer, I should say. He directed The Raid, The A-Team, Smokin' Aces. Okay, so, yeah, he, if you never saw Smokin' Aces, then you don't know who he is.
No.
It's a fun, weird movie. Weird.
Okay.
Oh, that was also 2006.
I don't think I can wrap my hand around Kenneth Branagh playing a guy who's based on Timothy McVeigh.
What?
Yep. So this is Joe Carnahan was apparently working on when he was developing it. And Carrie Ann Moss and Scarlett Johansson were going to be in it. And yeah. Tandy Newton was offered to reprise her role.
Oh. Oh, wow. This was JJ's first feature film? How did I not remember that? Good job, JJ.
I mean, for a first effort, it's not bad.
That's good. It's very good. Mm-hmm.
It's certainly better I
wish
do.
The first movie I directed looked this good.
Yeah.
And was this coherent and interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of the coherence probably has to do with his longtime partners, Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orsi, who he collaborates with like all the time. Although I don't think he works with them very closely anymore because Alex Kurtzman's gone off to do his own Star Trek stuff. And I forget what the other guy does. Didn't he do like The Leftovers or something?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't watch that.
No, that was Damon Lindelof. I don't know what Roberto Orsi's up to. But yeah. Yep. That's the thing.
JJ directed an episode of The Office?
He's directed a lot of stuff.
Why did I not know that? I want to direct an episode of The Office.
It's going to be a little hard, Dan.
Well, you know, we'll get the band back together.
Yeah, you're going to do the reunion episode. Everybody loves those.
Yeah. I would love to.
Mm-hmm.
It would be my honor.
Yeah. For some reason, I always think of JJ's first movie being Cloverfield, but it was not.
Yeah.
It was his second movie.
Literally not listed. Did he not direct Cloverfield?
No. He produced it.
Yeah, he's got a lot more, 68 producer credits compared to 15 director credits. I didn't realize it was that... unbalanced. I thought he kind of did a lot of both, but apparently not.
Well, I think it's one of those...
A lot of TV series is in here, too.
I think it's one of those situations where he produces a lot of stuff, which lets him have a lot of creative input, but he doesn't have to like see everything through to completion, but then right. He gets to go on the press tours, and everybody thinks that he did it. So,
oh, boy. Yeah. I mean, just look at his upcoming and announced stuff. Producing Mission Impossible 7 and 8, producing Untitled Star Trek sequel, Untitled Star Trek project, Untitled Cloverfield sequel, Portal, Half-Life, and let's see, what else do we recognize in here? I mean, obviously, Skywalker's in post.
Mm.
He's a busy fella, apparently.
No, Castle Rock. Yep. So, that's the stuff. He's got a lot of things.
Movies.
Mm-hmm. And TV shows.
Movies are good.
Not all movies do.
I enjoy movies.
Mm-hmm. I know you.
Producer on Westworld?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, on that note of us just reading facts.
Yeah. reading going, things on the internet.
Then I think we should wrap this one up. Let's, you know, end on a note. I forget what the music was at the end.
Thank you for tuning in. Make sure to tip your waiters and buy a mattress.
Yes.
Also, we have been defocused.
Also, we've totally quit doing this podcast until the next episode where we do this podcast. So stay tuned for that cliffhanger ending of whether or not we go on to live our own lives or whether or not we come back to this thing that makes a lot of interest for people who like it. So, yay.
Yeah. This is loss leader is what they call it. I think that's the term. We do it for the exposure, frankly.
I feel like I'm very exposed, suitably exposed.
It's really hot in here.
Yeah. Okay. I marked the end.